States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Paez and I are very pleased this morning to be joined by Judge Ed Reed from the District of Nevada. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to help us out here. We'll proceed with the first case on the oral argument calendar, which is United States v. Diaz-Villasenor. I probably mispronounced that.
Diaz-Villasenor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michelle Villasenor Grant, and I represent Pedro Diaz-Villasenor, the appellant. I'm from the Federal Defenders of San Diego. Your Honors, in this case, the District Court erred in denying the motion to suppress without holding an evidentiary hearing. The District Court found that there was reasonable suspicion to perform a non-routine border search without having any testimony or evidence to rely on. Now, what really is going on here is that the agents relied on the dog alert to perform the search that they performed. And I did not 28J this case, but I know my esteemed colleague who's going to argue shortly after me did. The Sedano-Arellano case, which was recently decided in this court, calls the reliance on the dog alert into question. That case holds that in order for a dog alert to be relied upon, the reliability and the credibility of that dog must be proven by the government. And that was not done in this case, even though it was asked for that the reliability be proven and the discovery on the dog be turned over. That was denied by the district court. Even taking out the dog alert, though, I realize that there are three other factors that the court relied on when she made her ruling that there was reasonable suspicion. She also found that, based on the government's proffer, that there was nervousness, shiny screws on the carpeting, and that the gas tank was solid. However, there are problems with this as well. Regarding the tank being solid and the shiny screws, because there wasn't any testimony, we don't know what that meant to the agents or if they had the experience to know what that meant. There was never any of that offered into evidence because there was no hearing. Regarding the nervousness, the Chavez-Valenzuela case has held that nervousness alone without other specifically objective factors does not support reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. So I believe that if you take all of those things into consideration, that there was not reasonable suspicion.
Hasn't the Supreme Court held that you take into consideration all these things, that you don't really rule out any particular characteristic?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. However, I feel that you do need to look at whether each of those factors are valid. I don't think that the district court can rely on invalid factors, and I think that when you take into account the fact that the dog alert was not, the credibility of the dog was never testified to and never shown, and that the gas tank being solid and the shiny screws being shown, we never knew why that was important to the agents. I think that those things taken out show that there was not reasonable suspicion.
Let me call your attention to the hearing
Yes.
on the motion to suppress. Actually, there were a number of motions pending before the district court judge at that day.
Yes.
And she dispensed with a discovery motion, and then she took up the suppression motion.
Yes.
And she indicated that the government made an offer of proof about what the facts would show. And then she asked defense, how does the defense respond? As I read the transcript, I didn't see where the defense said we need to have an evidentiary hearing so that we can cross-examine the government's proffer, the witnesses who make up the government's proffer, and we want to present some of our own. There's a factual dispute that the court must resolve before. I didn't see that in the transcript.
I understand, Your Honor.
Or even in the moving papers.
Your Honor, in the moving papers, I did ask for an
evidentiary. As I recall, I don't even recall that there was an affidavit in the moving papers.
That's true. There was not. However, the question would be, what could my client really attest to, or what could we attest to that we could know beyond what the agents knew? Because everything was based on the agents' observations, what the agents saw. We don't know what the agents saw. We couldn't perhaps say that.
Well, do you think you have any obligation to tell the district court that you want to cross-examine the government's witnesses You can accept their proffer, but you want to cross-examine the witnesses? I mean, is there any – do you need to tip off the district court or say
– Well, I think that that was clear when I asked for the hearing in the first place. In the moving papers, I asked for an evidentiary hearing. It was fairly simply put. I believe I just put that I would ask for an evidentiary hearing because I believe that the government has the burden of proving reasonable suspicion. And that was all that I asked for in the moving papers. In the hearing, I mentioned that I was concerned about the dog alert, and then I said that but if the government is going to rely on other things, and this is on the page 7 of the excerpt of record, then that would change as well, because I just wasn't sure what the government was going to be relying on. Then the government made its proffer, and the judge ruled. And I think that it was evident from my moving papers that I did want a hearing so that I could cross-examine. One of the other problems is regarding the nervousness proffer and the tapping on the tank and things like that. Those are credibility determinations as well that the court would make while the agent was testifying and being cross-examined. And although this court can't rely on anything in the record to sustain the to affirm the ruling of the district court, once you're in trial, all of that evidence about why the agent did a certain thing and getting into the details is irrelevant to the trial. And so that's not – and I don't think that that's a good answer.
Did you contest – was it your plan or your strategy to contest that the officer was able to see the bolts, the shiny bolts or the shiny screws on the carpet?
Well, basically, we didn't know what that meant. And what's interesting is what came out at the trial is that one of the things they testified about was that it was a very clean vehicle. And so perhaps the shiny screws were just as a result of the vehicle being very clean. In fact, both officers noted that. So it's unclear why that became such an important factor when separated from the fact that the vehicle itself was extremely clean. It's very unclear. I think that an evidentiary hearing was required in this case and that there was not reasonable suspicion shown and that was error on behalf of the court. I have a little bit of time left, so...
Do you want to save it for rebuttal or is there anything else you want?
I think that I'll save the rest for rebuttal.
Okay,
for you.
Very good.
Thank you.
We're from the government. Mr. O'Toole.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Patrick O'Toole on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, this case is yet another border case in the aftermath, frankly, of the Molina Terrazon decision that was decided by this Court a little over a year and a half ago. And I think it represents one of the problems with Molina Terrazon because you end up having a situation where if reasonable suspicion is required, because it's a unique border search or non-routine border search, the government does have to establish reasonable suspicion. In this particular case, while I think that there was reasonable suspicion, the position that the government has advanced before Your Honors in its brief is that this was a routine search, not requiring reasonable suspicion.
How do we ever reach that issue?
Because the government raised that argument below.
You didn't cross-appeal. The district court expressly refused to decide that question, right? She said, I'm assuming without reaching it.
That's correct.
So it seems to me the only way we reach the issue is if we first hold there was not reasonable suspicion. Do you want us to do that as a matter of law to the facts of this case to get to the issue that you really want us to get to?
No.
So why should we? I don't see analytically how we get there without saying, first, there's no reasonable suspicion as a matter of law.
Well, I think
because that's what the district court found.
The issue that is set forth in the page 8 of the government's brief, footnote 6, district court did not deny the suppression motion based on that basis. Rather, it assumed that it was non-routine without deciding the question.
Right.
However, the district court's denial of the suppression motion can be affirmed on any basis supported by the record, even if the district court did not rely on this basis, citing United States versus Montero Camargo, United States versus Gonzalez Rincon, United States versus Washington. And the government can elect which legal position that it wants to advance.
Yes, I have no doubt that you can raise that as an alternate theory. But it seems to me analytically, if we're considering the appeal from the district court's decision, the only way we really reach that is if we find first that the district court incorrectly concluded that there was reasonable suspicion.
Well, I guess the contrary, and I don't, the contrary position, I don't know if defense counsel will step up back on rebuttal, is to say that the government, by filing the brief the way that it did, has waived a reasonable suspicion argument. So I don't want to, you know, get the government mousetrapped. I think there was reasonable suspicion in this case. I think the district court was entitled to rely on the lack of opposition to the facts that were set forth by the government in the motion hearing. And we also had those facts, basically, that would have established reasonable suspicion that came out of trial. And the district court's entitled to rely on trial facts under the Wilson case, as well as any pretrial motion facts to substantiate any basis. So there was reasonable suspicion. But it's a fundamentally important argument, and the government can't be in a position in 4,000 border cases to bring two or three inspectors each and every one of those cases demonstrating reasonable suspicion when the core constitutional issue.
Right, but you know, we can't, we aren't going to reverse Molina Terrazon here. We can't, you know that.
No,
And in every case I've seen out of your office recently, you raise the question, you're entitled to raise it, but we're only biting around the edges of that.
Well,
I understand that you're upset about it, but.
I argued Molina Terrazon, and
yes,
I would have preferred had it gone the other way. It didn't.
Yeah.
And, it is the case that in one of the corresponding cases before this court, the government's filing a cert petition, and we'll see what happens to that issue long term. But the government does recognize and accept that Molina Terrazon is binding on this panel. I argue the Cedeno-Arellano case that counsel referred to. That was a gas tank case, but it was a dismantling and a removal of the gas tank. I did not argue, because I couldn't, that Molina Terrazon was wrongly decided, accepted the fact that we needed to establish reasonable suspicion, and argued that there was reasonable suspicion. But I do think, in the meantime, that it's very important that Molina Terrazon not be extended beyond the great danger exception that was exemplified. And this is not a Molina Terrazon kind of a search. It ultimately ended up being a gas tank search, but the gas tank was not dismantled, the gas tank was not removed, and what you have is a seat that is simply removed in the meantime. You have some screws that are unscrewed. You have a lifting up of a carpet, and you have a panel. The panel is opened up. Underneath that is the gas tank, which ended up being searched, remaining intact as it was from the very, very beginning. So this is not a Molina Terrazon kind of a situation, and I think it's important in this case. Vargas Castillo, that was decided 2 weeks ago by this court, Bravo, that was decided may or may not have decided ultimately on that issue because the court found reasonable suspicion, but the ramifications of Molina Terrazon are very important, and I think it's very important that this panel and any panel that has this issue not extend Molina Terrazon beyond what it is, and that's why the government's taking the position that it is in its briefs. We would accept
that. I understand that. Just because the district court didn't reach the issue, however, I'm just suggesting that there might be an unintended consequence of your argument.
Sure. And if this court decides this case based on reasonable suspicion, that's fine. I mean, if this court believes that the issue is important enough that the ramifications of Molina Terrazon need to be clarified, I mean, our district court needs guidance on this. When do they have to have reasonable suspicion hearings or not? Is it every property search case now? 4,000 cases we're going to have reasonable suspicion hearings? Does it matter if there's damage? Does it matter how much force? 25% of the border cases in San Diego are gas tank search cases. Are we going to have a district court have reasonable suspicion hearings week in and week out whenever it's a gas tank search, no matter what happens?
I mean, exactly how does volume implicate constitutional rights? I mean, that's not a consideration. I understand your practical problem, but analytically, I don't think it makes any difference.
It doesn't make a difference except for the fact that in Molina Terrazon, the court said it was a non-routine search. It's very difficult for me, and I think for someone who has worked these kinds of cases, to say that the area of the car that is most often used to smuggle drugs, which is the case, that 25% of all of the border search cases that we have involve gas tanks, I think that goes to whether it's a routine search or a non-routine search. Now, again, that won't be for this panel to decide unless the court ends up taking the issue in bank. But the most common area used to smuggle is a non-routine search seems to me to be counterintuitive. So the numbers don't control the Constitution.
I understand your concerns. I'm not, don't mean to put them dismiss them and put them aside. But I want to talk about some of the facts of this case for a moment. One of the issues they raise is that the district court did not conduct an evidentiary hearing here. Now, it was my experience as a district court judge on motions to suppress that we routinely conducted an evidentiary hearing. It was sort of the way we did business. And you made a comment there that triggered me. Is it the way they're doing business in San Diego, in the district court in San Diego, they're not doing evidentiary hearings?
It depends. I mean, they have evidentiary hearings every week. But many of the – there's a local rule that requires an affidavit to be filed or a declaration to be filed to put facts in issue. That didn't happen here. Now, in fairness to the defense, many judges will have an evidentiary hearing.
Right. This is a matter of course.
Anyways – not all judges do, and it will depend, but there were no contrary facts. I mean, the government produces discovery, files a motion response, the defense files a motion response. Everybody said that there was a dog alert. Everybody said that there was tapping on the gas tank, which would have provided reasonable suspicion under this court's decision in Bravo anyways. All those other factors regarding nervousness, the shiny screws, those were all there. They weren't contested by the defense. The judge says, you know, what's at issue here? So the judge doesn't have an evidentiary hearing. There is a trial. The same witnesses that would have testified at the evidentiary hearing testify at trial, and the agent gets into the exact facts relative to tapping the gas tank, there were shiny screws, how the search took place. So those facts were ultimately the defense attorney through a trial. Now, it's different, and I will agree that the defense attorney might have wanted to get into, well, what did shiny screws signify to you? And the district court may or may not have said, well, that would be relevant to a motion hearing, perhaps not relevant to a trial. But we don't have that effort. So where does it stop? I mean, the facts ultimately were there. They came out under oath. We have no disagreement with the facts pre-trial. We have no declaration, no affidavit filed. I think that the district court was well within her discretion not to have that hearing, and particularly in the government's view, because we think the core constitutional issue is important. To the extent that the court continues to give guidance on what is a routine search and what is not, if it's a routine border search, we don't have to have those kinds of hearings because reasonable suspicion, of course, doesn't matter, which is another reason why the issue is important. But those facts were there.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just wanted to address one thing. I don't think that I need to address, unless this court wants me to, the routineness or non-routineness of the search, because I agree that the district court held that it was a non-routine search, and the question really is whether the evidentiary hearing had to be held, and in absence of it, whether there was reasonable suspicion reasonably found by the district court.
Was the gas tank tapped? Did the evidence show the inspectors tapped the gas tank?
There was a in the trial on.
What about what was before the judge at the prior to the trial?
That's something that the judge did rely on. It's on the transcript of record, and page 9 is she lists the four factors she relied on, which were nervousness that the tank was solid when tapped, shiny screws.
All right,
on
thank
the
you.
Carpeting and the dock.
That answers that. I don't want to use up all your time on that.
Thank you. And I think that really the problem is with not having an evidentiary hearing is really what Mr. O'Toole did raise, is that when you get to the trial proceeding and the motion's already been ruled upon, to then try to delve into the same issues that has already been ruled on by the court, when you know that it's not relevant to the jury proceeding under the United States versus Dean case, getting into why these things were performed and what it means to the inspectors, why the effort has to be put forth is unknown to me. I think that it's clear that an evidentiary hearing was required here, and it may not be that we couldn't say that we contested that those things happened, because it's all based on what the inspectors did. And my client is sitting in a vehicle while these things are happening around him, and he doesn't know what they're doing, and he doesn't know what they're observing. And so I don't know what he could possibly write as an affidavit to say, you know, I can test that the screws were shiny. I looked at them myself. They were really dull.
I polished them.
And, right.
Yeah, I'm obsessive that way.
Yeah. So
I like just, a clean machine.
I'm just not really sure what could have happened in that case.
But you could say, you know, we accept the government's proffer, but we would like to cross-examine the witnesses.
Right. And you raised that previously, and I think that that's a good point. And I do think, though, that by asking for the evidentiary hearing, that's clear to the court that that's what we want to do. And I think that the court knows that it needs to make a credibility determination on a lot of
could,
these things.
Your client could say... the floor hadn't been cut in the back of the vehicle. Could have challenged some of these facts alleged by the government.
Well,
because your client, it's his car. He knows what is involved in his car. So wouldn't he have an obligation to challenge some of those facts to put them at issue?
Well, that's possible. And I think that the facts in this case were that it was not his car, if I'm correct. But I think that that's possible. The problem is that, and I see that I'm out of time, if I can.
No, go ahead. Please answer.
I think that the problem is that one of the arguments is that the non-routine search already occurred before they got underneath the carpet to where the cutout in the ground was, the cutout on the floor. And I don't think that would have really changed anything. I think that the four things that the...
You can say I wasn't nervous. I was just having a bad... day after a bad night or something, couldn't he say, well, that's an improper allegation that I was nervous?
Well,
it seems to me there's some facts he could have raised which would have flagged it for the judge then to hold an evidentiary hearing.
I understand, Your Honor. And I think that the problem was that the conclusion of nervousness is something that the court came to. And the in the papers and at the hearing, the prosecutor really laid out the identifying things of which the court has previously held to be signs of nervousness, such as a carotid artery pumping and shaking hands and things like that. So I don't know how he could say that he doesn't recall that his artery was pumping. We know that it was. Whether it was visible or not, it's an entirely another question. And his shaking hands and things of that nature, those are all observations made by the government agent, and I just don't know what, if anything, he could have contested about what the agent saw.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. The case just heard will be submitted. Thank you both for your arguments. The next case on the oral argument calendar is Arbatsounian versus INS.
Please the court. My name is Howard Davis. I'm the petitioner. And I'd like to reserve about 2 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to focus my remarks today on the issue of well-founded fear. And in an asylum case, an applicant need only show that there is a reasonable fear of persecution. And in looking at the reasonableness of the fear in this case, I suggest to the court that it is fit into the court's continuing discussion on cases like Kotaz and Progeny, subsequent cases Magoyan, Hoxha, which was just decided earlier this year, where the issue of reasonableness in analyzing this, it's not limited to just an individualized fear, but is a sliding scale, a continuum from individualized all the way to pattern and practice and possibilities of disfavored groups, and that the more evidence there is of a particular group being targeted, then the less there is of a need for a more personalized showing. And in this particular case, what we have here is within a larger group, those were members of the Dashnak Party. And within that group is a family that has been active. Main petitioner's husband and father and mother. And during what we see here is the gradual pushing out of this family from Armenia.
Seems to me that the husband going back to Armenia is kind of a hard thing to overcome. How do you overcome that proposition?
Well,
he goes back even though he's been threatened, he's been beaten. He goes back, which casts some question on credibility of the situation.
Well, the reasons for the husband going back was he had an ill mother, and he himself was a doctor, and he was going back because out of a concern over his mother's condition. And I would say that this court has held in other cases, for example, in Demes Job, 787 Fed Second at 1332, where in that particular case, it's a Nicaraguan case, the applicant went back to Nicaragua, where he's from, and spent 2 years unharmed. And he went back out of the urgent concern about family members. And the court did not the court still found that that he was able to meet his burden with regard to asylum. And so what we have here is the gradual pushing out of the family, going from starting with the husband's detention and beating, which petitioners witness, subsequently and also the husband losing his job before that because of his activities. After the husband left, the same individuals who took the husband initially came back and began asking as to his whereabouts. Then there was the receipt of anonymous calls, and then the petitioner in this case, the lead petitioner, was fired from her job, again because of the family's Kadashnak connections. In addition, the parents of the petitioners were beaten and detained and imprisoned due to their Dashnak activities. In fact, petitioners' fathers died as a result of such beatings. And she and the co-petitioner saw him in the hospital. Petitioner's mother, same thing, and she came to the United States at the same time as the petitioner, and she herself was able to get asylum in this country. And then the younger petitioner witnessed what happened to her family. She herself mentioned that she had she was called derogatory names because of the family's political affiliation, and she herself was followed. And then the proof proof is in the pudding with regard to the concerns of returning, so that, as was questioned earlier about the husband's return, but after the husband's return, he again had problems, and that he had been detained and arrested by members of the Armenian National Movement, which were the same individuals who had several years before had detained and harmed his family. So,
As far as the petitioner and her daughter are concerned, what indication is there that they might suffer persecution, except that the husband has suffered it, the mother and father suffered it? There is this one threat in June of 1991, but what else is there from which you could infer that she might fear that she would be hurt if you was sent back?
But the cases don't require it. The court has held in earlier cases that even an absence of direct persecution against her personally, if the person's able to demonstrate a well-founded fear based on acts of violence against friends or family members. I would say that that we have this is in a certain sense a little bit similar to Magoyan. The petitioner in Magoyan the petitioner in Magoyan, there were not direct threats against her afterwards, which her big concern was about what happened to family members, and a lot of her family members were forced to leave. I mean, she did have some problems before, as did the petitioners in this case.
I don't want to use all your time up.
Okay, so I'm going to speak a little bit.
Okay.
If there's any more questions before I... Okay.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Jamie Dowd on behalf of John Ashcroft, the respondent. I want to focus on a couple of things that opposing counsel said. He was particularly concerned with the fact that the petitioner's family had experienced problems in Armenia, and therefore the petitioner would experience problems. But what he failed to address is there has to be a nexus between whatever problems the family experienced and problems that the petitioner may or may not experience. And there's failure here to prove that there was a nexus. She never testified that anyone questioned her about her father or her husband's political activities. She never testified that anyone would impute a political opinion to her or asked her whether or not she held the same political opinion or expressed any belief that she held the same political opinion. So the record doesn't support a finding that there is a nexus between any harm that may have been experienced by her father or her husband and any harm that she may or may not experience.
Now, there is a threat made against the family that if you don't get out of the Dashnak, if I pronounce that right, party, then somebody in your family is going to be hurt. Isn't that a pretty good nexus?
Well,
that's the June of 1991 threat.
To address your question first, I want to say she was never actually threatened. Her husband received, I believe, whoever these men were who came and detained him for a day said to him if he didn't leave that his family could be at risk. But the petitioner herself was never actually threatened. But the husband also lived in Armenia from June of 91 to June of 92 and experienced no problems. The record at 168, 169 wasn't threatened, wasn't harmed in any way. So just that one threat alone, this court's precedent under Lim, threats could be simply threats of future harm without evidence to show that the family had been otherwise harmed wouldn't qualify.
Right, but she was personally threatened at least once, right?
I have that she received telephone calls and visits for men looking for her husband, was never actually threatened personally herself in any way. I also want to address, I believe, what opposing counsel said regarding that there was, she witnessed, because her husband has gone back to Armenia, but the sister was in Armenia the whole time. So, the arguments as to that he was concerned about his mother's health and had to go back to help care for her are a little live in the same town as the mother. Testified on the record at 2
that he's still there, that he returned. only him, but him and his family. There's a threat out there. It's regardless of
whether you receive it directly or whether somebody else was the recipient of that threat. The thing is that problems
suffered by family
when you're looking all around you and members of your family continue to have danger, then that is an indicator that members of your family are in danger. There is clearly a nexus there. And in looking at Lim, in court in Lim, the fact that a person may have stayed for a period of relative unharm after suffering the harm is really of no moment. While it might affect in the analysis whether or not one suffered past persecution, it still could be the basis for a well-founded fear. And in my briefs, I also argued how this case fits into Lim. So unless the court has any other questions, I must submit.
No.
Thank you both for your arguments. The case just heard will be submitted. And we'll proceed with the next case on the oral argument calendar, United States versus Asagira Aguirre. I mispronounced it.
Asagira.
Asagira
Aguirre.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Shereen Charlotte, Federal Defenders of San Diego, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Antonio Oseguera Aguirre. Mr. Oseguera's conviction should be reversed for a number of reasons, several of which I'd like to discuss today. First, there was the improper admission of the numerous prior crossings, the text evidence. Second, there are issues surrounding the prosecutorial misconduct in summation and in the admission of the in-court experiment, as I'll call it. And finally, if I have enough time, I want to address the search of the vehicle and how Sedano Arellano impacts upon the reasonable suspicion determination. In the first instance, the text evidence, the 8 prior crossings of the border by the suburban car, should not have been admitted under either rules 401, basic relevance, 404B, the prior acts rule, and 403, it simply wasn't relevant for any proper purpose. It certainly wasn't relevant for the two purposes asserted by the government. First, it was relevant for one purpose, but we agreed to stipulate that as to the text crossing on the day of the arrest on July 7th, that we would agreed stipulate that time should be admitted, that one record was indeed relevant. The government refused to accept that stipulation, refused to be satisfied with the admission of that one crossing. Rather, they came back with the theory that, we need to admit it, district court, because it shows that Mr. Oseguera shouldn't have been nervous when he crossed on July 7th, because he crosses all the time. Now, the problem with that theory of admissibility is it simply is far too attenuated, and especially in light of the test,
if he wasn't nervous about crossing the border, isn't it suggested that he might have been nervous because he had a load of marijuana on the car?
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, had the government been able to establish two things, that would be a fair inference. First, they should have been able, in order to admit this evidence, to establish that he actually was in the Suburban on all of these prior crossings. They cannot do that. They did not do that.
Would it be a reasonable inference to draw that he was the registered owner of the vehicle?
He was the registered owner, but I don't think.
Could you draw? But would it be a reasonable inference that he was driving the vehicle when it came across those other times?
I don't believe that it would be a necessary inference, and
I didn't ask that. I said, would it be a reasonable inference?
No.
Okay. Why not?
I mean, anecdotally, I can tell the court that as a public defender, I see many, many, many cases where people are driving a car that is not registered to them as they cross the border. I think that is a common occurrence. So I don't think that the simple fact that he's the registered owner of the car alone is something that should permit that inference, especially in light of the number of prior crossings and the potential alternative use of the testimony. I think that there should have been something more to establish that he indeed was driving. All the government can show from that evidence is that the car crossed. All they could really prove was that the Suburban shouldn't have been nervous.
So is that a proper subject of argument? In other words, the fact that it comes in at all is something you can say, well, you can either put your client up there and ask him about it or make the argument. As you just said.
Well, the problem in this case was actually, I don't think it is really a reasonable inference, but the problem in this case was compounded by the district court's limiting instruction, which basically told the jury, and it's at excerpt of record.
Yeah, I see it.
Okay. They basically told the jury, you can consider it for his demeanor.
Well, it said it was limited to the demeanor.
Right. But essentially that came a couple days after the testimony already had been introduced in the case. Mm-hmm. But I think that the district court was telling the jury that that's what it's there for. That's why it was introduced. So the jury's going to assume that he was indeed the driver. The district court didn't say, jury, it's up to you to decide, as is done sometimes in other 404B instructions. It's up to you to decide whether or not he drove the car on those particular occasions. And that's not what this instruction said. I think this instruction has them assuming that indeed he was the driver.
Without that instruction, though, don't you think the prosecution could have argued that, you see, he's crossing the border and transporting drugs all the time? I mean, it seems to me that the court was trying to limit the inferences that the jury might draw from that.
I agree with you, and I think that the best way to prevent those type of bad inferences would be not to admit the testimony. I think its utility and relevance was so limited in light of the risk of the dangerous inference. I thought there should be a limiting instruction. I told the court that.
Did you offer one?
Pardon?
Did you offer one yourself?
My limiting instruction that I offered was at ER 526. Yes. I told the court that I wanted a limiting instruction to state something to the effect that there was no evidence he was engaged in any illicit smuggling activity during the prior crossings. And I specifically objected when he proposed this one at page ER site 659, saying, I object. I think that you're telling the jury to consider it as to his demeanor. And he overruled my objection.
There was another part of his limiting instruction, which was it was also limited to the mechanical aspects of the vehicle.
That's right.
Now, as I recall, the defendant resided in Los Angeles.
Yes.
So that was a pretty long haul from L.A. to the border and back. Why? And there was evidence that the Suburban was not mechanically working properly. Why wouldn't that? I mean, now wouldn't it be a reason? Wouldn't it be a reasonable inference to draw that if that vehicle could make that number of trips from L.A. to the border and back, that car was in pretty good shape?
I have a few responses to that. First and foremost, that wasn't the government's theory of admitting the evidence. And under this court's precedent in United States versus Mayans, they have to set forth the evidentiary basis, the theory of relevance, and why they're seeking to admit the evidence. They stated repeatedly, and they continue to maintain on appeal, in the response brief at page 20, they state unequivocally that this evidence was admitted for two limited purposes. First, to show the time of the crossing on July 7th. Second, demeanor. They have not traveled under the theory of operability.
But the limiting instruction, though, was limited to the mechanics. Something about the mechanics of the
operability.
It throws in a sentence about the operability of the car, but that was just the district court's sua sponte discussion of that.
So what's wrong with that?
This is what's wrong with it. First of all,
I mean, lots of times, you know, when I was faced with a need to fashion some sort of limiting instruction, lawyers would propose something, or I'd come up with my own limiting instruction and just tell the jury, this is what you can consider the evidence for, and that's what the district court judge did here.
Well, I don't think that's a proper purpose either, because it's the government who put at issue. When the district court first the district court at one point during the trial indicated to us at excerpt of record page 426 through 430 that if we put on evidence about the operability of the car, if the defense put it on, and indeed we had mentioned it in our opening statement, not knowing that he was going to rule this way because he had not discussed this ruling, he said if we put on evidence regarding the operability of the car, then the prosecutor could bring in all the other texts, which is all the crossings into Mexico as well, and that the car was never referred to secondary, never seized by Customs Service. So we made a decision, and that's on the record. We didn't call our expert witness. We did not call witnesses regarding the operability of the car, which we indeed had planned to do and had told the jury this was not just pulling this out of my hat. This was indeed proposed testimony. It did not come in for this strategic reason. The government themselves introduced evidence regarding the operability of the car by introducing all the receipts, and they did so for their own theory, which was, yeah, the car might have been having these problems, or, hey, here's all these receipts. This shows that Mr. Oseguera was fixing any problem himself. He's a skilled mechanic. He fixes these things himself. That was their theory. And so under this court's cases in Sanchez-Robles, in Castillo, they can't put a fact at issue and then get to introduce 404B about that fact. It needs to be something responsive to the defense's claims.
Did you make any statement in your opening statement, any contention in that regard?
Yes. In fact, we did. And we researched
that. The car wasn't running well?
Yes. Yes, we did. But we researched that in front of the district court, who made a ruling that that did not open the door to the other texts regarding on the issue of operability. He said, no, it's just opening statement. Opening statement is not evidenced by the lawyers. And indeed, had we known the district court's position, we wouldn't have gone forward with that opening. He didn't tell us until subsequent to the opening statement. But it has never been the government's theory in the district court, nor in this court, that operability is the basis.
So the judge made a ruling after your opening statement, it's not going to be allowed, I'm not going to consider this car running funny business?
He said, well, what the judge's ruling was at excerpt of record 426 through 430 was if we put on evidence about the operability of that car, she was going to be able to bring in all the texts in all its glory, all 16 crossings, the times, the dates, the gory details. And so we made a strategic decision. I told the court.
Now, did this come out in the government's case in chief, the text evidence?
Yes. It was admitted in the government's case in chief, as well as the admission of all of the receipts and any evidence on the operability of the car. I think that in terms of the government's argument that Sanchez-Robles supports admission of this testimony, I think I dealt with that fairly well in the reply brief. But first of all, Sanchez-Robles says no less than four times that that's a matter for rebuttal, and the reason why it was relevant in that case, and indeed inextricably intertwined, was because Mrs. Sanchez took the stand and said, yes, I crossed the border. No, I don't know this man. I've only known him for 1 month. And my daughter borrowed the car on this night. The text directly refuted all of those points. So, in a sense, indeed, it was a part of the case because she had put that at issue. And that's a large distinction between Sanchez-Robles and the Kearns case and what happened here. And that's the distinction in the inextricably intertwined cases. I know the government filed a 28-J letter citing some of those, and probably due to some communication difficulties within my own office. I hadn't received it. I'm sure she sent it to me, but I hadn't looked at it till this morning. I don't think those cases say anything distinct from the principles that she's already enunciated in the brief. But I'm going to review them. If there's something else I need to add on that particular issue, I'll file a responsive letter.
Okay. Do you want to get to the prosecutorial misconduct?
Yes, I do. The prosecutorial misconduct issue, first I want to note that there was an objection to the argument, and that objection can be found at excerpt of record page 701. This is not a plain error issue. And the government, I think, recognizes this to a degree. They cite both standards of review. I think the standard of review for this court is abuse of discretion. And it's not a plain error issue for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that there was an objection. But I also filed an in limine motion to exclude this type of testimony and necessarily argument, though I certainly wasn't planning on there being argument on something that was an improper ground. But that in limine motion is at excerpt of at CR 24. And immediately after the closing argument, the judge, in discussing this, said to me, well, you opened the door to this structure evidence anyway, or to the structure argument with this no tools argument. Thus, he didn't find that it was a plain error type issue. He addressed it and essentially said to me, I would have let this in. I would have let in the testimony. I think the argument was proper because you made this no tools argument first. He was wrong as a matter of fact, and I cited the court to the excerpt of record page 698. The prosecutor raised this. She raised it by introducing the receipts, and she said, I'm introducing the receipts because I want you, jury, to see he's a skilled mechanic. I also raised it in a new trial motion, which I didn't include in the excerpt. It's in the court record at 41 and 42. And in there at page 5, I specified the transcript cites to that argument, the improper argument, and the objection. The government at supplemental excerpt of record that they have submitted with this court, page 104, they responded to the new trial motion, and they never once said, I waived anything. They never once said she didn't object to this. The hearing transcript is part of the designations on appeal. It's not in the ER. I can easily include it. There was never a discussion that I waived it or I didn't object. The court just didn't agree with me and ruled against me. At the opening brief, I also said this happened over defense objection. So I think it's clear that there was an objection. I think the argument that they made is specifically what's prohibited by United States versus McGowan. In McGowan, the expert witness, as Your Honor is quite familiar, testified that, you know, this is like GM, this is a business, you know, they have employees. And that's essentially what this argument said. Pineda Torres says you can't make that kind of argument. And I think that in light of the additional testimony by the value expert during his qualifications that he infiltrates narcotics smuggling organizations, he's an expert in narcotics smuggling trafficking, as the prosecutor told the jury, and these are at ER site 465 and supplemental excerpt of record site 49, that coupled with this argument is error. And it infected the trial, and it should requires reversal. And indeed, the cases, both McGowan and Pineda Torres were cases where the defendant didn't testify, yet the error was deemed sufficiently harmful. This court's recent decision in the Cervantes case validates the kind of defense theory that we were traveling under, this lost load theory. So I think that the combination of Cervantes, McGowan, and Pineda Torres do indicate that reversal is warranted here, that we had a valid theory, the error was not harmless. I say I have 3 minutes left. I'd like to reserve that.
Okay.
May it please the Court. Deborah Rhodes, the United States. If I may, I'll begin with the allegation of prosecutorial misconduct in the closing argument. This is not a case that should be properly analyzed under Vallejo and its line of cases. This is not a case where there was any expert testimony or any affirmative testimony at all by the government of a drug organization.
So why is it the proper subject of argument then?
Well, the argument here was very unlike argument that would be made in a Vallejo case. It didn't talk about the compartmentalization of roles. It didn't talk about the growers, the packers, the people who recruit drivers, the drivers themselves, the distributors. It didn't go through that whole litany. And in Vallejo, McGowan, Pineda, all of the cases that discussed what the harm in Vallejo was, the harm in Vallejo and its cases is that a single driver who's not charged with conspiracy is linked with all these other people as part of the organization.
The argument is kind of a off-the-wall argument, isn't it? Not supported by any evidence, the thing about structure?
Right, and structure was not argued here. If I can characterize or summarize what was argued here, and it's found in the excerpts of records 706 to 709, what was argued was, let's look at the defense. The defense is a lost load. In the opening statement, the defense made it very clear that the theory of their case was that he was an innocent, bona fide purchaser who had purchased a Suburban, driven it for 4 months, and unbeknownst to him, there was marijuana in the gas tank, and that there was a lost load. It was a third party. It was some other person who somehow put it there. Well, that was clear that that was their theory of the defense from the minute of opening statement until closing argument and all of the cross-examination in between. And the government simply said, let's look at that. That's the defense they're putting on. Is that a reasonable defense? And in doing so, the government said, what kind of drug trafficker, not meaning the defendant, what kind of drug trafficker, the unknown person that he's pointing at, would run his drug business that way? Because let's face it, marijuana is a drug business. That's what drew the objection. That's on page 708.
Yes, it's a business. Drug smuggling is a business.
And the reference to business there, and it's not like business is some nasty word, the reference to business was the
organized crime.
What, she didn't say organized crime. And the business is validly inferred from the record. That's the whole point of putting the value testimony on. The government asserts that the value testimony, the expert testified, this is $31,000. Mm-hmm. We all agree that marijuana is there for distribution. It's a commodity. It's there to be sold. That's why it has a market value. The defense even argued that in her closing statement, that she was trying to say, who's going to sell this moldy old marijuana? Obviously, when it got put in there, it would have been put in there when it was fresh because it was there for sale. So this wasn't a contested fact, and this is a fact that's reasonably inferable from the record. It's a commonsensical fact. The government was simply saying, what kind of business person is going to, A, stick $31,000 worth of something into a gas tank and then sell the car for $2,000? That makes no sense. That's not believable. That's not plausible. You're not going to forget about $31,000 and then accidentally sell your car for two. The other possibility is that someone stuck it in there while he owned the car and he didn't know about it. But that also makes no sense because how is this person supposed to recover the marijuana, which is very valuable?
Except that's not what the argument said. The argument said the best way that the reasonable business person, the reasonable drug smuggler, knows the best way to get product to an intended destination is so they can make money to tell the driver, to tell the person who's going to take it, to take it wherever they go.
Right, and that's the culmination.
Which is sort of the, you know, unintended. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, I mean, that borders pretty closely on the...
Well, she's arguing knowledge. Knowledge is what's up for grabs here. That's what the jury has to decide. And she's saying, and I believe, if I'm correct, that's at the culmination of her argument. She
yes.
first explores the implausibility of, well, I hope that somehow I can track this car down, and I hope that I can sneak inside the gas tank again and unweld it and get my $31,000 out. She says something to the jury like, that's a hope and a prayer. And then she ends up saying, the much better way for a businessman to run his business is to simply tell the driver it's there so he can retrieve his valuable product. And the government asserts this is very much like the testimony that's allowed in Murillo, not Vallejo. The harm in the Vallejo cases, as I read them, is that you have a driver who's now linked with a whole crew of people, each of who has a specialized job, when there's no affirmative evidence other than the expert to those other people. Murillo, on the other hand, says, hey, look, you can put in unknowing courier testimony. You can put in an expert that just says, and this is based on Cordova, you can put in an Encompass, you can put in an expert that says, look, drug business, I don't know if they say business people, drug people aren't going to leave a very valuable commodity in the hands of an unknowing courier. It doesn't make sense. It's not plausible. And the government believes that this argument is squarely within, and it's the only argument, it's not an expert, as Maria and Cordova would allow. It's simply logical inferences based upon the value of the marijuana and the defense that was put on from the very get-go from the opening statement. So I've cited Acheson in my brief, allowing reasonable inferences from the facts. I have also cited Garcia-Glazar, which talks about the defense can open up something in opening statement and make it relevant.
Okay. I think we've got your argument in hand on that. Why don't you move on to the admission of the tech evidence?
Thank you.
Evidence. I don't mean to cut you off, but I want to make sure you get to your points.
Thank you. I was making my transition. The text evidence, first of all, is admissible in both the case in chief and in a rebuttal case. That's something that Vega recognizes itself on page 1153. It specifically talks about 404B and specifically text, and says whether the evidence is used in the prosecution's case in chief or for impeachment. There's no rule in Vega that it's not allowable in the case in chief. Similarly, that's not, the government maintains, the proper reading of Sanchez. Factually in Sanchez, procedurally in Sanchez, it came in the government's rebuttal case because it was responding to the defendant and the defendant's witnesses having taken the stand. It was responding to facts that only became relevant once the defense was presented. That's unlike the situation here. Here, the relevance of the text and the reason that it was offered initially was to rebut the defendant's false exculpatory statement that he had been in Mexico for 3 hours. That's relevant because if the defendant lied about that, it's more probable that he had knowledge of the marijuana being put in his vehicle in Mexico. That would be the reason to lie. In addition, it's relevant, the seven prior crossings, and it's seven.
Well, the crossing of the on the day in question, I don't think that even the defendants acknowledged that it would be relevant, admissible, and everything else.
I take it that she now is conceding that point, and so I'm happy.
She seems to, she stood up here and said that at trial that she stipulated that that could come in.
You know,
and the government refused to accept the stipulation for whatever reason the government chose. But so the real problem is with the prior seven.
Okay, and I'll move on. But I, for the record, the government did never stipulate there. There was an offer to stipulate by the defense. Apparently, it was lost in the shuffle. There's a long record. But on pages 497 and 657, she maintained her opposition to all the text evidence.
Okay.
So in any event, on the seven, those are also relevant because they go to the cause of the nervousness. And that was something that the court, that the jury...
Well, how does that work, though, if there's no showing that she was in or that he was in the vehicle at the time of those prior seven crossings?
There is no showing, and it is based upon a reasonable inference. In the government's position...
Well, why is it a reasonable inference? That's what I asked defense counsel.
A reasonable inference for two reasons. Because he is the registered owner of the vehicle, and it's not necessarily the case that he's going to be driving his car at all times, but it is reasonable to believe so. And Sanchez specifically addressed this fact. Sanchez specifically addressed relevance and the argument that the text reports were irrelevant because it didn't reveal the driver. And also, in that case, there were two cars that were related through text. It didn't reveal any communication between the two cars. And the court found, this court found, that that didn't matter as to relevance. And the court in this case, so I would say Sanchez is actually controlling on that point. The fact that we don't know conclusively or with certainty that he was driving on those days does not make it irrelevant. What it does mean is, based upon a reasonable inference, it makes it more probable that he was not nervous on the day in question.
Why is that?
Yeah.
Why, so, I mean, if he had testimony that said, we saw him all the seven times and he wasn't nervous, that would perhaps be relevant, but perhaps he was nervous every single time.
Well, and that would also go to the weight. And that was something that was fair game for cross-examination and fair game for argument. In fact, counsel did on page 520.
But what is the preferred way of going through crossings to not arouse suspicion? Because the cases say he looked too calm. He looked in the mirror. All these are given as indications that, and if one appears nervous, then that's an articulable fact. So I'm reading the cases, I've been unable to discern how one ought to act going through the border. Regarding to demeanor going through there to not,
well, all of
not
that,
be subject to secondary.
All of that is up for grabs. I think it's clear after Arvizu that the totality of the circumstances must be considered.
We're not talking about reasonable suspicion to stop. We're talking about we're in trial.
Okay. Yeah. So the weight,
I sent you off in the wrong direction.
Sorry, that was my fault.
Huh?
The weight of the evidence is what's at issue here. And Sanchez says that that evidence is admissible and relevant, notwithstanding the fact that we don't know for a certainty that he was driving the car. And the court said that that's something that the jury may infer and is not required to infer. And she, in fact, pointed out in cross-examination that we don't know who the driver was. She was free to cross-examine on that point. She was not limited on that point. And she was free to argue that point. I would make an analogy to this. It's like phone records. You can have a phone record showing calls being made to another number. You don't know with any certainty who's on the phone. But it does make association or some other fact and issue that they're being offered for more likely than not. More likely because of the connection. It's like bank records. You don't know who makes a deposit or who makes a withdrawal, but you know who the account holder is. And I would submit that it's similar with these text records.
How about the argument that defense counsel made with the limiting instruction, which suggested to the jury that he was in the car?
The limiting instruction was first proposed on government or excerpts of record 526. And specifically, defense counsel objected to the form that the court proposed. And the court said to her, why don't you write a form that, or an instruction that you would like? And he offered that she should write one and submit one. And then the second limiting instruction, the record's silent as to whether or not she ever did that. I don't believe that that happened. Then the second limiting instruction was submitted. And counsel agreed as to the form. That was excerpt 657. And then when the instruction was given, there was no objection. That's government supplemental excerpts of record 86. So it's clear that she objected to the evidence itself, but she had an opportunity to submit a limiting instruction to her liking and apparently did not do so, was invited to explicitly by the court, did not request a contemporaneous limiting instruction when the evidence came in, finally agreed to the instruction proposed by the court, and did not object when it was given. So the government believes that the limiting instruction, in fact, reduces any prejudice that she might be arguing. That combined with her the ability to cross-examine and to argue about this evidence to begin with. Also, I think it's important to note that the court excluded a lot of text evidence. And let me come back to the third reason for it being relevant. The third reason for it being relevant wasn't something that the government initially offered it for in the motions in limine, but it's something that became relevant when the defense said during opening statement repeatedly, and it was the defense who raised this issue, who said the car was malfunctioning. In fact, we're going to call an expert witness who's going to tell you that if you had this in your gas tank, this is precisely the kind of problem that you would have, and we're going to call other witnesses who will say they rode in the car while it was malfunctioning, and there were all kinds of receipts, or there were all kinds of repairs that the defendant tried to do on the car to figure out why it was malfunctioning. He just never figured out why it was malfunctioning. He didn't know it was the marijuana. All of that's in the opening statement of the defense, which is in the government supplemental excerpts of records. So, during the trial, the government now said, well, you know what, the texts are not relevant for third purpose, because who's going to be driving this car that's completely unreliable all the way down to Mexico from Los Angeles? And the court said, look, to the defense, you said that in opening. I'm not going to let the government go into any more trips to Mexico and the times of the trips, because they were late at night. I'm not going to let them go into that unless you tell me you are, in fact, going to make good on your opening statement. You've opened the door, but I'm going to let you keep your fluidity, the fluidity of your defense, and that's specifically excerpts of record 495 to 500. So he says, even though you opened the door, if you tell me you're going to back off it now, I won't let the government talk about any of the trips to Mexico, nor the late time at night going into Mexico. And the court in this case limited the text evidence very much, did not let the text records themselves come in, did not let the summary chart come in. The texts were offered only by oral testimony. That's excerpt of record 515. Kept out all the trips to Mexico, kept out all the times of the trips, kept out, and this is the government's argument, and I can see I'm not going to have time to fully make it, but I think I've addressed why we believe the evidence is relevant and was proper to issues pending at trial. I'd like now to briefly address the theory that we believe is more correct. The court admitted it under 404B, and we do not believe that that's a basis to reverse, because we believe it was admissible in any event, and the court can affirm on any ground under the Alexander case cited in the government's brief. But at the same time, the government believes that the proper legal theory for admission was inextricably intertwined. The government believes that Sanchez is controlling on this point, that this case is on all fours with Sanchez, except for the fact Sanchez is offered in his rebuttal. But I don't think that procedural difference makes a difference here, because here the issues that were at stake were already at stake in the government's case in chief. And in addition,
did the judge admit it as intertwined?
No, he admitted it as 404B. The government offered a theory as inextricably intertwined, that it was intrinsic evidence, specifically intrinsic to his state of mind at the time he was committing the crime, showing his nervousness, intrinsic to his knowledge of his own guilt, his consciousness of guilt, therefore the false exculpatory. So the government's theory was that this evidence was intrinsic.
So again, we're back to the fact that his car went through the border and we don't know anything about his demeanor, and therefore it's relevant to show that he was nervous when he went through the border? I mean, I'm not being facetious, but that's your theory.
It's based on inferences. There's the inference, if it was his car, it's reasonable to believe he was driving it before. And if he drove through the border before,
yes,
it's reasonable to believe that he would not be frightened or nervous simply by the border procedures, simply by...
That's a really tough inference to draw on a routine basis. I'm not driven to that border, I don't know how many times, and every time I go through that border, I get nervous. You know, I mean, you're building one inference on another, on another, on another. Is there any limit?
I think there's two.
Where's the limiting principle of that inference?
Well, there's two inferences here. Two inferences. One is that owners often drive their car. It's reasonable to infer he was driving his car, and it's reasonable to infer that he's familiar with border procedures because he's crossed the border before. That would make him less nervous. That would tend to show that the cause of his nervousness was his own knowledge of the marijuana rather than being confronted with the border officials. And this goes to weight. Doesn't this go to the weight of the evidence? Isn't the jury...
And that's a lot to put on nervousness, a subjective judgment to begin with.
Well, there's no ban on evidence of nervousness.
I mean, I understand that. But, I mean, then to have all this supporting testimony that he must not have been nervous because he's been through before, it just seems pretty attenuated to me.
It was fully examined on cross-examination.
I mean, the real point was to show some prejudice, wasn't it? Not a nervousness. That wasn't your point. I mean, you hoped to get it in that he was making a lot of late-night crossings. And the judge didn't let you go that far.
That didn't come in.
I know it didn't come in, but that was...
And the government didn't use this for a 404B purpose. That's why we don't think that it's 404B.
It's hard to see how it's 404B evidence. Now, I mean, you haven't talked about the 8038 admission, which may be your strongest argument. I don't know.
Well, that goes to reliability. That just has to go to objections that shouldn't come in because it's not reliable.
Yeah.
It's a public record under 8038, and the officer laid the foundation for its admissibility, which he would have to do in addition to relevance, saying the procedures for how...
Okay, I take your point.
Okay. Yeah. So it comes in as a hearsay exception under the 803. The relevance is what I've been addressing, and I just have a little bit of time
left. That's right.
I would like to say this. I'd like to say inextricably intertwined is the right way to go. And then finally, there's no prejudice. Okay? There is no prejudice. You may not like nervousness testimony. You may think it's up for grabs.
No, no, that's nervousness is fine. I'm just saying that then layering all this other evidence on top of the observation of nervousness to show that the observation was, in fact, truthful.
Except for the day of the arrest, how would the prior crossings be intertwined?
The prior crossings are intertwined because, again, they go to the state of mind while he's committing the crime. The government's 28-J letter citing all the other circuits shows that the language in Carnes and Sanchez that says 404B, which is extrinsic, those are acts that are meant to reflect adversely on character. That's central to 404B. This was not used to reflect adversely. We weren't saying these prior crossings were drug crossings, or these prior crossings show he's a bad person, or these prior crossings show he has a bad character. We're saying the prior crossings just tend to show familiarity, therefore reflecting on the cause of his nervousness, which the jury would have to determine. I'm out of time, but I'd like to say harmless error by spades, because this is a guy who's a registered owner, driving a car long distances for 4 months, making repairs on the car, offering a defense he never delivers, and the seven crossings didn't matter.
Okay. And you didn't get to the search, but if Mr. O'Toole or Mr. Haynes ask, we'll attest that you really intended to attack Melina Terrazon, but we cut you off because of lack of time.
I'm embracing
it. Okay. I first want to state that the precise problem Judge Pius identified with this testimony is that it requires inference on tenuous inference, and in light of the potential alternative prejudicial use of the testimony, that simply shouldn't have been admitted. And I couldn't disagree more with the prosecutor's characterization as harmless error. This was a case where he presented a defense that he bought the marijuana with with marijuana already concealed inside it. There was testimony from a government agent that the marijuana was crumbling and falling apart. There was testimony from the defense that the marijuana.
So who's a bad businessman?
Pardon me?
The crumbling and falling. Well, I suppose,
But indeed, there was concrete evidence to support the defense.
Right, but there was. But in a sense, though, they did find a lot of marijuana in the car. And explain to me why this isn't harmless error at the end of the day.
At the end of the day.
And the other crossings. I mean, it may, in light of the limiting instruction and everything, why isn't this harmless error?
In the first instance, I think that the prosecutor improperly argued that he crossed 8 times, but this is the time he got caught. And that's at excerpt of record page 701. I think that was an improper use. I think the fact that the limiting instruction didn't come for 3 days, and at the time that the evidence came in, we discussed the possibility of limiting instruction, and no one could agree on one. And that's why there wasn't one given. But the harm occurred. And
what words did the prosecutor use? That would add up to that. He crossed a lot of times before. This proves that he was one of the people.
At excerpt of record, page 701, she stated that we know he crossed before. He crossed 8 times. At least we know he did between the date he bought the car and the date he got caught with the drugs. And those were her words. I think that the jury could easily have inferred, hearing that testimony, hearing that in the opening statement, this is a case about marijuana smuggling, hearing evidence that from a narcotics smuggling expert, that he was smuggling on those 8 prior occasions. And make no mistake, that's exactly what they wanted the jury to think. And that's why this testimony was introduced. And she argued, well, this is the date he got caught. And I think that jury clearly was being told to draw the inference that he just didn't get caught those other times. The marijuana wasn't packaged, and that's a fact that every single witness admitted was highly unusual. This wasn't a slam dunk for the jury. The jury was out a full day and a half. They came back with a note at excerpt of record 775, 777 that said they were deadlocked. And then they wanted to see the marijuana again. And then they still deliberated another half a day before coming back with the guilty verdicts. The other cases which have been reversed where, for the same non-constitutional error, where there wasn't a coherent theory of defense, and I think less coherent than this one, Pineda-Torres and McGowan and Cervantes validates this defense theory, demonstrate clearly it wasn't harmless error, this nor the prosecutorial misconduct in the closing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. Very well presented. The case just heard will take under advisement. We'll proceed to the next case on the calendar, and we are taking them slightly out of order from the printed calendar. We'll take the Villamire versus Santa Ana case first.
Good morning, Your Honor. Donald Cook for the plaintiff, Mr. Villamire. There's no question here that obviously what happened to Mr. Villamire, as he describes it, is not only excessive, but it's outright malicious criminal. The first question is really, can officers, these named defendants, these six defendants, who are identified in Officer Luna's report as being present, some of whom are identified as using some force against Mr. Villamire, be held liable for what Mr. Villamire describes happened. And they can't. The cases, Rutherford versus Burkett, Santo versus Gates, they can be held liable. Whether the fact finder says it was Graham who put the dog on him, or it's just Graham that ordered the other officers to stand back so the dog could be put on him. The argument regarding the other three defendants, that is, if I pronounce the name correctly, Coates, Blazovic, Gonzalez, those were the three Doe defendants who are also the subject of the next Villamire case, presents a very interesting issue. You know, Rule 16 of the federal rules of good cause requirements versus California law on naming Doe defendants. If this case is in state court, they're brought in as Doe defendants. There's no requirement that Mr. Villamire conduct some type of discovery, exercise diligence after the filing to identify him.
That's the California rule now.
That's the California rule, but it applies here.
And explain why you think that trumps the district court's discretion under Rule 16.
Because the pleading of Doe defendants and the tolling provisions for naming Doe defendants is a matter of federal substantive law as a result of the 1983 borrowing statute. Wilson versus Garcia says the form states period of limitations, including tolling and applications, are a matter of substantive law for purposes of the 1983 action. They apply here. And, of course, in Mr. Yagman's Cabrales case, the argument there was is that Rule 15 and its relation back requirements, et cetera, didn't work. Same reason. For the same reason in this case, Rule 16 shouldn't work. It shortens the period of limitations for suing defendants. It imposes.
When is it proper for the district court? Is it ever proper for the district court to say you've got to substitute Doe defendants in by a certain date? I mean, can you do it right before trial? Where's the limit?
Part of that is maybe on a case by case basis. Sure, you have a defendant, for example, who's concealed the identities of culpable parties that are within that defendant's control, and the defendant has had an opportunity to defend the action. In that case, I would submit you can even bring him in, reinstate Doe defendants, if it's still within the 3 years of filing the suit, right up to the time of trial. So the outside limit is for sure 3 years, and a shorter limit, well,
I'm sure in state court that those judges that are faced with their need to expedite their delay reduction programs that they have in state court, that limits are placed upon getting all the parties into the case.
but those limits are nowhere near as strict as what you're faced with in federal court. First, in federal court, you cannot conduct discovery after you file the complaint. You have to wait until the scheduling conference order. Here, no discovery could be conducted before June 25th, 2001. Then discovery was cut off in September of 2001. You've got that narrow window in which to conduct discovery. In this case, requiring that Mr. Villamayor show good cause, given the restrictive right of discovery, that requirement cannot apply.
I can't recall, but in the scheduling order, was there a limitation on sometimes in scheduling orders they'll say, by such and such a date, any Doe defendant shall be brought into the case. Was there that limit?
That kind of language. What it said is September, I think it was 25th, 2000, uh-huh. The last day for bringing in parties. That's what the trial court relied on, one of the orders it relied on in dismissing the three other defendants because it was past the scheduling conference cutoff date and there was no showing of good cause. Look, sure, a court can set a time deadline for naming Doe defendants. But pretrial, we had not even come to the pretrial conference yet. We're not talking about coming up to the day of trial. So,
had the discovery date passed by that time? On the date that you were to have all parties brought into the case?
It had already passed, correct. So, again, there was a very narrow, short period of time for discovery.
Did you ever ask to have the discovery period extended?
Well, I did not ask because once I got the reports which identified these three officers as actually using force, not that just that somehow they were involved, but that they had used force, I immediately named them as Doe. And then I also, of course, filed this separate lawsuit, the second Villamayor lawsuit. So there's really no reason for me to ask for a reopening of discovery. But of course the problem I had, according to the trial court, is I couldn't show good cause for determining these persons' involvements before September 25th of 2001.
When did you get the police report?
There are several police reports at issue.
Right.
Officer Luna's report I had before the lawsuit was filed. And although he identifies all the officers just by listing their names, he only identifies six as actually being present and using some type of force when Mr. Villamayor was arrested. And those are the six that I named originally. In January of 2001, I got additional reports in which the three other officers are identified as actually using force against Mr. Villamayor. And then, of course, I name him as the defendant, and I file the second Villamayor lawsuit. And this is even well before any pretrial conference, this is well before any summary judgment. So, and within less than a year after the lawsuit was filed. Again,
had the pretrial conference been scheduled?
I'm sure it had been because it should have been covered by the scheduling conference order of June 2001. So it had been scheduled, I'm sure. I just don't know offhand. So I don't think, given these facts, you can enforce the Rule 16 good cause requirement. You have to go with the California law on naming Doe defendants. And in this case, it's no different than the defendant Black in the Cabrales decision, who's brought in 2 years after that lawsuit was filed.
Well, I take your point on that. The unfortunate thing, and I guess one thing we have to consider, is the fact that you didn't raise this in the district court, the Cabrales argument.
Oh, that's incorrect.
Okay, show me. Do you have a record site for that so we don't make an erroneous conclusion?
It was in.
You can save it for rebuttal if you want. I don't want to.
Okay. First, it was my opposition to the motion to dismiss.
Or you could supply a 28J on that, because I think that's an important point that's been.
That
we couldn't consider it on our own, given the fact that you're denied a substantive right here, but I think if you've raised that, I think that would be an important issue. So just get that to us.
If I can turn to a related issue, the officer's photographs, okay? I mean, come on. We've got a question of identity here. We know there are a lot of officers present. Mr. Viehmeyer can identify some. Obviously, identification can implicate some, exonerate others. We asked for photographs. The magistrate judge says they're not relevant, and the district judge upholds that. It seems so patent that photographs of potential wrongdoers are relevant, at least reasonably calculated to lead to discovery of admissible evidence, that that has to be error. And it would seem also pretty clear how that prejudices Mr. Viehmeyer. He doesn't identify who's responsible. The other defendants all argue, we're not liable because you haven't identified us. This is an issue that recurs over and over again in these kinds of cases, identifying the right officer. It seems like if this order stands, what a plaintiff has to do is he has to just name every conceivable officer.
Did you suggest a protective order?
I'm sure I did. I know that I argued to the district judge that if there's really a problem with some type of privilege, make a protective order. That's what you do. Now, I know the other side argued before the district judge and before this court that, well, this implicates privacy concerns or privileges. There has never been a single piece of evidence put before either the magistrate, district judge, or this court to support that claim. Now, it may be true that some officer has the need to have his or her likeness dissemination restricted. Fine. Make a showing. But don't come in and say that, well, we have to keep our images under wraps just as a matter of general principle, not when you're running cop shows, not when you're giving TV interviews, when it serves the police interest, and not when you present not a single piece of evidence from anybody to support that claim. And obviously, if the claim is legitimate, yeah, you can fashion some kind of protective order. So I think it's...
Well, now, Mr. Viehmeyer, the purpose of the photographs, was it to assist Mr. Viehmeyer in identifying who was present, or what was the whole purpose?
To identify who did what, who was present, is what not only for Mr. Viehmeyer, but also witnesses. Was this officer there? Is this officer there? I mean, we've got the report that's before the court, and it was in evidence before the district judge, Looney's report, suggests that it was Officer Graham who ordered the dog to bite. Now, of course, there's mention of another report which never came into evidence, which says it was this officer, Coates, who actually ordered the dog to bite.
Is that part of the record anyplace?
Officer Coates' report never came into evidence. It was offered by the defendants in their summary judgment motion, but the district court struck it for lack of proper authentication.
Really never became part of the record.
Correct. It never came in on the summary judgment motion.
Would you say that this? I'm sure you're familiar with the Rutherford case and the Betty Jones case. Where does this case fit in to that situation?
Well, we've got a group of officers, at least some of whom are using, according to the plaintiff, using force maliciously in a criminal fashion. Some are standing there. Plaintiff cannot identify with precision, but a jury can infer that an officer who was there, according to the reports, according to the police accounts, either used the force or stood by and let fellow officers use the force. That's how it fits in. It's not a requirement that you identify an officer by name, rank, and serial number. That's what those cases stand for, and that's what we have here. We don't have that type of identification, but we do know they're there.
I wonder, does the Betty Jones case really say that just being there is enough?
Well, no. You know, you have to have an opportunity to intervene, right? And here, you know the facts of what happened. You know, he first gets beat up inside the room, knocked through a window, goes out in the driveway, and gets knocked down and handcuffed, and the dog is put on him. Well, I submit that during the course of that event, that was enough time for an officer to intervene, to do something. And they didn't do that. Instead, they laughed and joked about what
they
were doing.
So are you referring to Rutherford and Betty Jones as a matter of failure to intervene or the acts of the officers themselves?
Well, it really stands for both, because where you cannot identify the officer who's using the force against you, but the fact finder may find that the force was used, it was excessive, and officers were present, then the officer is going to be liable on one or both of two bases, using the force or failing to prevent your fellow officers from using the force. That's what I read those cases as standing for. If I can shift gears to the other defendant, David Reber. Judge Paez may remember him. Look, he goes out there and he tells these cops, he trains them, as he admits even in his declaration, I train him as to, you know, the legal limits of using dogs. And our position is very simple. You train these officers that the dogs are like grabbing somebody by the arm. And that is carte blanche, essentially. To the officers, you can get away with using the dog because it's like grabbing somebody by the arm. You can do anything with the dog. And, of course, that's not reality. Everyone knows, should know, what you're really dealing with. But they engage in this fiction because they can back it up with what David Reber says, what their own department, who follows Reber's lead, says, is that these dogs are like tightly grabbing someone and just pulling them down to the ground. He shouldn't be doing that. If he's going to train them as to when to use the dogs, then he should tell them these dogs are likely to cause serious injury and you better use them accordingly. But he doesn't do that. Now, you've got these state issues, state action issues. What you have here is Santa Ana hiring an outside contractor to provide training on an ongoing, regular basis to its officers on the use of force. That is sufficient to show state action. As to the negligence claim, look, you know the officers are going to be using dogs to attack and bite people. You know the dogs are likely to cause serious injury, but you train the officers differently. That's a breach of a duty that runs to people like Mr. Villamayor who gets bit. I have about 4 minutes left. Unless there are questions, I'll save it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Do you have a time agreement? Or just everybody's going to, it's a grab bag, everybody's going to do their best to speak? Is that
exactly.
I'm okay. Go right ahead.
Brief here, absolutely, because I do not want to get upon Mr. Dingman's time, who represents Mr. Reber. I'm Bob Dado. Good morning, Your Honors. I represent the Santa Ana defendants here. And I'll try and keep that in mind. And not Trump, or Tramp, rather.
No, that's fine.
With the court permission, I guess I might as well take the issues in the order that Mr. Cook presented them. First, as to the Doe Amendment issue, I mean, as set forth in our brief, the city contends this is an issue of federal civil procedure, not state civil procedure. As Judge Paez recognized, even if the state law somehow applied, there are trial court reduction rules and circumstances in which in a California state court, you don't have 3 years to name a Doe defendant. It's not some sort of an absolute state right that trumps federal civil procedure. For those reasons, we would set forth that.
So do you see any principal difference between Rule 15 and Rule 16 in terms of the application of substantive California law in this instance?
Not really, no.
Yeah, so, I mean, aren't we stuck with that? Depending on your point of view, it seems to me that under these circumstances that we have a borrowing statute under 1983, and we don't have any direct law in Rule 16, but if California law applies under Rule 15, I don't see any principal reason why the same rationale shouldn't apply to Rule 16.
Well, then I apologize, Your Honor.
You may have omitted too much.
I may have, because that's not what I intended. I do, in fact, see a principal distinction.
Okay, tell me.
Between those two, in the sense that 16 is a purely case management procedural sort of mechanism, and one in which it's the parties that suggested to the court, by the way, what these deadlines were. The parties knew at the outset that amendment of unnamed defendants was was likely to occur. That's right in the order. This isn't something that Judge Carter came down and said, you have to do something by X date. This is something the parties agreed to and submitted to the district court. And contemplated early on, there might be a situation with fictitiously named defendants. So I do think there's a principal distinction there, and one which, at the very least, plaintiffs invited. They're the ones that came up with the deadline to begin with, and that is in the record. So I do think there's a principal distinction here, and one that it particularly applies here, where for months plaintiffs' counsel is aware of the documents that would identify the officers that he later attempted to name. No dispute as to that, and set forth in Judge Carter's order in some detail.
Of course, if California law applies, it doesn't matter, because due diligence doesn't seem to be a requirement.
Well,
if it applies.
If it applies, certainly if you know the identity under California law, at least as I understand it, if you know the identity of a defendant and you don't name him, her, or it, and then you later attempt to use the Doe statute and claim, well, yeah, I knew, but I just didn't name, that's an improper use of the Doe amendment under state law. We'd submit that's exactly the situation you've got here in the sense that you're on notice.
Well, the California law is pretty clear, though, that due diligence isn't required to name a Doe defendant.
But if you know and you still don't name, that's at least as I understand it, that's a problem under state law.
If you know the party or at the time you file your complaint, that's a serious problem. You can't rely on the Doe provisions to do that. But let me ask you this: why if due diligence? And I think that's correct under California law. I may be mistaken, but my understanding is it's not required. You know, the scheduling order in Rule 16 is kind of move the case along. Let's be diligent about getting this case through the system as quickly as possible.
Correct.
So why aren't we sort of indirectly under Rule 16 adding a due diligence requirement to adding Doe defendants?
I think it's simply another mechanism to encourage people to be diligent to move the case along. In that sense, I guess it's somewhat redundant. It's an encouragement of law.
What's your understanding today in California law with respect to the trial court's ability to place time limits on certain events?
My understanding, and we can certainly brief this in more detail because you know that the detailed discussion of this is not in the briefs, but my understanding is that the trial court has a tremendous amount of flexibility depending on the kind of the case in terms of scheduling things in order to get the case along and get it tried within a year or whatever. That's my understanding of how it works in general. I can't cite you chapter and verse, but that's my understanding.
Well, I know there was a period of time when the trial courts tried to impose discovery cutoff dates that were inconsistent with the statute.
Exactly.
And the courts of appeals said, no, you can't do that.
You betcha, because you can't have local rules that somehow preempt the California Code of Civil
Or judge-made rules.
Or judge-made rules, or local rules, something like that. And that's certainly the case. If you've got something that's inconsistent with statute, that's improper. At the very least, the parties have the minimums prescribed by the California Code of Civil Procedure, as I understand those cases. And I think that's all that those stand for.
So why isn't that the case here? You've got the state law that prescribes the Doe procedure. Can you trump that by an order issued under Rule 16 or a state law equivalent?
And I would submit for the reasons that we've set forth in brief, yeah, that's a matter of federal civil procedure, not state civil procedure. And it's not the same sort of a situation. That is our position on that.
Right. No, I think I understand that. I mean, the difference here is if given under 1983, you have the borrowing statute that may import some of the substantive rights under California law. That's the argument.
Right. That's where that issue is joined. That's certainly the case.
In the California situation, is the judge in violation of state law if the judge shortens the period for naming Doe defendants? And says, I don't want to wait 3 years. I'm going to make you do this within 6 months, would that violate that state statute?
I don't believe so. I'll tell you why. And I can't say categorically no because I can't think of a case off the top of my head. But if what the trial judge says is, look, we're going to get this trial, we're going to get this case set, and I'm setting you a trial date right now. It's 6 months out. And assuming that goes forward, obviously it's not going to be 3 years that you have to name a Doe defendant. I am not aware of any case law that says setting the trial 6 months out violates Code of Civil Procedure Section 474. That's within the trial court's discretion to set the timing of the proceedings. And the fact that 2.5 years later your 474 time expires, I think, is irrelevant. But to directly answer your question, Judge Reed, I don't know of a case directly on point, but it wouldn't make any sense. Very few cases go 3 years anymore. When the Doe Amendment statute was originally enacted, as I recall, it was not uncommon at 4 and 5 years that cases would go. Obviously, that doesn't occur these days, and it seems to me it can't. I don't know of a case that says this is a violation of 474 because you set your case in 6 or 9 months. So it can't set an absolute 3-year deadline. That makes no sense from a judicial administration point of view. It can't operate that way, or that can't be what the legislature intended on 474. That would be.
Would you address the photographs?
Yes, I'll be happy to address the photographs. The orders from both the magistrate judge and the district court are obviously before you, and the district court basically held the privileges that are implicit in the city's arguments here. The magistrate judge adopted those. The district court thought that there's no abuse of discretion, which is the standard we're operating under here. To address the prejudice, I can concoct a scenario under which, if plaintiff had tried alternate means of discovery and had been shut down and came back to the magistrate or to Judge Carter and said, look, this is the only way we can identify these officers, you might have a case for abuse of discretion under those circumstances. But the bottom line here is that there was no other discovery attempted. So in the city's estimation, there's no showing of prejudice because no other avenue was attempted. It seems to me that if you're going to show abuse of discretion, you've got to do your homework, so to speak.
Is that the rule, though? I mean, why do they have to attempt other means of discovery before?
In order to show prejudicial error.
Well, no, I understand that. But, I mean, in terms of their entitlement to the photographs for the purpose of identity, why do they have to? Why is there a legal requirement that they have to engage in other forms of discovery? I don't think there is there?
What I am saying is that
I understand your argument, but it seems to me that also implies that the plaintiff should have done something else other than ask for the photographs before engaging in discovery of identity through the photographs.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not suggesting that. I didn't mean to. If I made that temporal argument, I'm not intending to do that. But what I am saying is if a motion is made regarding the photographs and that goes against you, I think you have an obligation to attempt to identify in some other fashion before you can come to this or any other court and say, this was prejudicial, I couldn't get it any other way. And that's what I understand to be the plaintiff's argument. This was the only way that I could show identity, so therefore it's an abuse of discretion.
I take your point on that, but why wasn't it relevant evidence?
We've got two sets of photographs. Are you talking specifically about the photographs of the officers as opposed to the dog bites? Because I don't want to confuse. I'm not going to stand up here and say, and I don't believe that the city contended below, that the photographs of the officers themselves were irrelevant. My understanding of the argument was it was highly prejudicial.
Why is it prejudicial?
It's because of the nature of the work that these particular officers do.
You can have all kinds of protective orders.
I understand. Those were not proposed, as far as I know. It was a we get them or we don't sort of a situation. And under those circumstances, it's a question of do you have an abuse of discretion by denying that particular form of discovery? We submit no.
Is Your opponent argued that there was no evidence to show officers' safety was endangered by showing their photographs. What about that?
What the city argued below, what the record demonstrates here is, no. Was there a specific evidentiary showing officer by officer? No. I'm not going to stand here and say there was. The argument was made, this is what these officers do. There is authority for the proposition that that puts these officers in danger, and that's what the record is in front of this court. And we stand or fall on that showing, but that's what it is. And under those circumstances, then it's a question of abuse of discretion, and it's also a question, at least in my mind, what happens then? Even assuming it's error, what happens then? And the answer to that question is nothing. Nothing happens then. No other alternatives. We've already been there. I'm not meaning to repeat myself.
Yes.
But we do think that is relevant to the equation.
Well, it is odd to be at this stage of litigation and have identity and at issue as to who did what, and the city resisting, apparently, any attempt to identify the individual officers and their role.
If you disagree with that,
I see you do. Go ahead and tell me why.
I'm sorry. My body language is talking way too
right.
loud this morning because I don't believe it's a fair characterization that the city was resisting all efforts to identify these officers. It's true the city was resisting one effort to do so. Absolutely. I'll agree with that. I don't think it's a fair characterization to say that is the case on a global basis. There's no interrogatories. There's no depositions. There's nothing attempted to identify these officers in any other way. And that is what the city believes is the problem here. Nothing ever else attempted. Pretty logical manners that we can all think of to identify these officers. No resistance there.
So you're saying if he just asked you who they were and who did what, you would have said, okay, I'll tell you right now.
Interrogatories or depositions, we don't know. It was never attempted. And that's the record that we have here, which is nothing.
Was there any, at the early meeting of council, was there any exchange of information?
On the early meeting of council, I don't know. That is not in the excerpts, and I can't tell you off the top of my head. I've got trial counsel here who would know that answer right off the top of her head. I don't, as I stand here. I do know, and obviously that's what is in front of you, is the initial disclosure, and that comes about 3 months after the case is filed, if I've got my timeline right. So a list of all of those documents is there early on. One thing that Mr. Cook happened to mention in his presentation was that the discovery cutoff was the same as the time limit in which to name Doe. That is not correct. If the court looks at excerpts of record page 24, the discovery cutoff is about 3-4 months later. The Doe cutoff is basically late September, and discovery cutoff isn't until the following January, the end of following January. There is time in there. 4 months difference between those two things. So there was time to do discovery under those circumstances.
But the Doe time period already expired.
That's true.
So in order to add a Doe defendant, he would have had, during that 4 month period, he would have had to go back to the district court and ask for an order amending the scheduling order, and to do that, he would have had to show good cause.
True, and he would have had to have overcome the fact that in late June, he's got a list of the documents that identify these three officers, and yet nothing happens until the end of September when the Doe cutoff expires. So that's true, and that's the problem. It's that 3 months that nothing happened.
When did he learn that these three officers were involved?
He states in a declaration.
I mean, to the extent of having abused his client.
He states in a declaration that comes January 2002. He states that he doesn't actually review the reports that are identified in June 2001 until January 2002.
But the reports were available to him, or he had the reports that showed these officers were involved?
What he had was he had the list of documents in the initial disclosure, and under the rules as I understand them, if it's in the initial disclosure, all one has to do as a party is to informally request that the other side send it.
That's supposed to take place at the early meeting of council, listing of documents and an agreement to exchange information. He didn't serve us with a set of interrogatories.
No, I understand that. Sure.
Or a request for production of documents.
Right. But certainly early on, all the list of the documents that the city thinks it's going to rely on are before him. That's in June. The Doe Amendment expires in September without anything being done.
Well, there are. Some of what these interrogatories are that I have before me, Officer Graham and others respond, and the question is, what is the identity of each person, including yourself, who was present at the place of the incident, the immediate supervising officer, and describe involvement of each person? Subjected to on lengthy basis, and the defendant, Graham, says he was assigned and describes that in a one sentence, and then says the other information is in the reports. I mean, they did ask, as far as I can tell, unless I've got...
What I don't know, and I can't represent to the court one way or the other, is what the date that is, because I don't know off the top of my head what the date is. That before or after the Doe Amendment cutoff, and I don't know. I don't want to miss
December 17th, 2001.
I'm sorry?
December 17th, 2001.
Okay, so it's after the Doe cutoff. It's before the discovery.
Well, that's the answer. I don't know when it was propounded.
I don't either, and I don't want to misstate. Was there some discovery propounded at some point in time? Yes, there was.
Okay. There are 14 seconds left of your total time.
Oh, boy, I tell you. Under those circumstances, then, if Mr. Dingman wants to address briefly, I would ask the court's indulgence. Only
yes, we will. He's here, and we'll
overuse my time. Yeah. So, thank
well,
you.
We asked a few questions.
I understand, but it's my obligation to manage my time. So, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Wally Dingman. I represent Mr. Reaver and his business, Adler Horse, in this case. Your Honor, first of all, I'm aware, I believe, that at least one member of this court has some understanding of the history between my client and Mr. Cook in terms of litigation.
You're talking about Judge Paez?
Yes.
Or me.
And unfortunately, I do too, which puts me in somewhat of a subjective position, and I'm trying to avoid
it
that.
Sounds like you had a mutually, as far as the legal fees are concerned, it's been a mutually agreeable relationship. It's been a lot of business for your firm.
The problem is my client doesn't have any insurance, and so he's putting the belt on.
Okay, that was being facetious, obviously.
Your Honor, first of all, I appreciate Mr. Cook's admission that his client's testimony was that when the dog was placed on him, he was already handcuffed and on the ground. That basically raises the issue that there was no evidence whatsoever ever presented in anything that was produced by the plaintiff in response to my motion for summary judgment indicating that Mr. Reaver teaches that. And, in fact, Mr. Reaver in his declaration says that he doesn't, and it's very obvious, I believe, that no right-doing person who has been in business for 25 years would do something like that. With respect to Mr. Cook's argument against Mr. Reaver that he trains dogs on the legal limits of the use. Mr. Reaver does have an attorney come out and give a legal class, and in fact, you're looking at him at this point in time. There's been other attorneys that have done it in exchange with me, but I've done a majority of that. What Mr. Reaver does, and it's a result of inartful questions and depositions and self-serving interpretations of the answers that Mr. Cook got in those depositions, what he does is he trains how to use the dog, how to control the dog. He doesn't say, well, if the defendant does this, then you can use the dog, or if you know these factors, then you can use the dog. It's simply a matter of teaching how to control the dog. With respect to the argument that Mr. Reaver is somehow negligent or unconstitutional in teaching the dogs that, or teaching the handlers that when the dog bites, he simply grabs an arm and doesn't do any serious injury, I believe that you would have to believe that the officers are so ignorant that when they go through their training period and they have to take bites as a result of part of the training, which has the purpose of teaching them what the dog can do in terms of a level of force. And the officers are well aware under the Rutherford versus Dorley case that it's a serious use of force, and they know that. And as a matter of fact, I recently read a pleading in another case where Mr. Cook himself said it should be reasonable to any officer with regular mental facilities that a dog bite is going to do some damage, and especially in this kind of an environment where the suspect is trying to get away.
Are the trainees, they have to submit to being bitten by the dogs?
Yes, but they don't do it without equipment. I don't want to mislead you on that fact, but that's part of teaching what the level of force is that a dog constitutes.
They bite some kind of a mitt or something, the dog?
No, sir. Usually because police dogs are trained for body bites, which is because of the, you never know when you're going to be able to get the dog on the suspect, if in fact it's necessary to do that. They're trained on bite suits. And bite suits cover the whole body except for the head and hands.
Okay, thank you. I don't want to use all your time.
That's okay. I really don't have anything else other than I believe that when the record is replete with reasons, like Judge Carter said, there was no evidence produced as to Mr. Reaver's involvement in this thing, any possible causation that he had with respect to this. I will also point out this. In my initial disclosure, with respect to one of the officers that's in the matter that you were dealing with about the Doe defendants, I disclosed only that handler. That's Officer Quijas. I disclosed him early on and said, this is going to be one of our witnesses. Mr. Cook did no discovery on my client. And our reason is because of the past history he's got. He's got reams and volumes, and I can't tell you how many depositions he has of Mr. Reavers. And so he didn't, I'm speaking for him, and I probably shouldn't, but he didn't need to take Mr. Reaver's deposition. He didn't need to give us discovery in this case because he had all the answers. Unfortunately, all the answers came in 1991, 93, 95, nothing current. He didn't even have a deposition where he said, do you still do this? Do you still do that? If I'd have been there and the questions were as bad as they were initially, I would have objected, and because they tend to be vague and ambiguous and don't get an answer that really helps anybody. With that, Your Honor, unless there's questions, thank you very much.
What has happened over the years is that Mr. Reaver, with the assistance of his attorney, has gotten religious about what to admit to and what not to admit to. There's never been any showing that Mr. Reaver's training has ever changed. With respect to the Cabrales argument that Judge Thomas raised, you'll find it in plaintiff's opposition to the motion to strike the Doe defendants that was filed February 13, 2002. It's at pages 140 to 141 of the excerpts of record.
What was that again, page?
140 to 141.
Thank you.
A couple of other details. My opponent is correct. The day for last day for adding parties was September 25th, 2001. The discovery cutoff date, however, was January 28th, 2002. We'll find those dates in the scheduling conference order.
Suppose the date to add Doe defendants had been after the discovery cutoff date.
Well, you would still have the same problem because you've got you have to show good cause. And under the scheduling conference order, and the argument would be, well, I take that back. In my case, if I had the date, a later date, then presumably my Doe amendments would have been timed.
Well, theoretically, I mean, you can't really complain about a discovery cutoff date.
No, you can't complain about a discovery.
And so presumably, if you're actively pursuing your discovery and, you know, moving the discovery along. When discovery cutoff ends, you presumably have all the information you need to go forward.
Well, sometimes you do. I mean, certainly the court may presume that you have all the information you can expect to get under the discovery rule, but of course, as a litigator, you may still be gathering information, and you can, of course, gather information outside of the discovery process.
No question about that.
So, but if we had had the last day to add parties after the discovery cutoff date, then my Doe amendments would have been timely because the DCO was January 28th and I filed the Doe amendments before January 28th. Incidentally, the defendants have confused this somewhat. It's true, right from the start, in the early meeting, the defendants disclosed the identities of the three officers, Blasovich, I think Gonzalez, and the other dog handler. And there was some reference to reports by them. But the actual reports themselves, which actually described what these officers did, were not produced until January of 2002. And that's in the excerpts of record at page 144, paragraph 7 of my declaration. They do not dispute that.
When were they finally disclosed?
The reports themselves were not produced until January of 2002, actually a few days before I filed the DOA amendments. The names of the officers were known before, and I don't want the court to think that that's when I found out their names. I knew their names even before I filed the lawsuit.
They're you say produced, was that in response to a request for production of documents? Or?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's when I got them. There was a dispute between the attorneys as to what the agreement was on disclosure of documents. My position was that documents would be voluntarily produced. The defense counsel, Ms. Shen, said, no, you still had to make a request for production. We only agreed to identify. And anyway, as I say, that's disputed. For the law on naming DOA amendments, the General Motors case, which is cited in the brief, is a very good case because it reviews, it's one of the best summaries of California law on naming DOA defendants. And it's not just the identity, it's the involvement of the DOA. Right? You have to know both.
That's at the time of filing.
As of the time of filing, correct. There is a California case, with permission of the court, I'll provide the citation, where the Court of Appeal held it error for the trial court to prematurely dismiss DOA defendants. And with the permission of the court, I'll submit that case. The magistrate judge did not rely on any claim of privilege. All you have to do is read the magistrate's order. This is his order denying production of the photographs. It's just that it was not relevant. The trial court
in California, can the judge shorten the DOA naming deadline to shorter than 3 years by setting the trial, as your opponent has suggested?
Well, by setting the trial, sure. But other than maybe setting an earlier trial date, then I don't think the California court has that power to do that. With consent of the parties, you can agree to dismiss all the DOA defendants. But
judge says, I want to clean up this calendar. I want the DOA defendants disclosed within 1 year. Would that be violation of California law?
Yes, I think it would be. And I think there's a case on it. And with the court's permission, I will provide the citation on that case. I'm already over my time.
Let me ask you one question, though. In terms of your theory now as you stand here today, your theory is that Quijas gave the order for the dog to attack. I mean, it's a little bit ambiguous between the two cases. And you've either got to say Graham or Quijas, it seems like to me.
At this stage, at the summary judgment stage on the VMI versus Santa Ana case,
right.
I take my best set of facts, the evidence in that case, which is I got the report by Luna saying basically Graham ordered the dog to attack, right? At some point, when I get to trial, I'm sure it's just going to be one officer, and it may be it was Quijas, all right? I don't have to make that election right now. What I do know is obviously there's evidence indicating it was Quijas who ordered the dog to bite. I do know that, which is why I want to bring them as a defendant. So I don't think it's fair to hold me to an election at this point.
Okay. Well, you really argued the Quijas case next, so you can talk to you about that. Anything else you want to say quickly?
Reavers claimed that, well, I don't teach them to use dogs maliciously. Well, neither does Santa Ana. But Santa Ana, we know, as the municipality, can still be liable under a Monell-type theory. Reaver is any different than the supervisors in the Chu versus Gates decision who could be held liable for their defective training. It's just that Reaver's a private party, whereas contracted to hire to work for Santa Ana, whereas the Chu supervisors were obviously LAPD officers.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Cases heard will be submitted. And we'll proceed with the related case on the calendar, which is Villamayor versus Quijas.
Glad I have an ample opportunity to rest up for this argument.
Yes. I thought we had different counts on this. We don't? I guess not. Okay. Very good. Go ahead.
Of course.
I think we can probably cover this fairly quickly.
Yes, I think so, because although technically not an issue here, underlying this lawsuit is, of course, that conflict with Rule 16.
Right. If you prevail in the other case, then this case is moot.
Correct. Correct. Even if I did not prevail for some other reason in the first Viemeyer case, I would say, look at the position plaintiff was in. If he had filed this action in state court, he wouldn't have had this problem with the Doe amendments. But he does have the problem because it's in federal court. Is there any prejudice to the defendant? Absolutely not. I mean, it's like prejudice to Mr. Black in the Cabrales case being named 2 years later. They're represented by the same counsel. The same facts are at issue. Obviously, what I'm trying to do here in filing the second lawsuit is avoid a possible adverse ruling on bringing in these guys as the defendants. And incidentally, the second Viemeyer case was filed before Judge Carter made his ruling in the first one dismissing the Does. And I mean, I was trying to cover my bases.
Okay. I think we have your argument at hand on that. Why don't you save whatever time you have for rebuttal and we'll see.
I will.
If,
yeah. I'm done.
Okay.
And I don't want to be redundant either, so I guess what I'd like to do is emphasize one point, and I'm not meaning to go over into the other case. However, I would, with that caveat, I nonetheless feel compelled to say that on that in the initial disclosure, it's not just the names of these officers, at least as far as Officer Quijas is concerned. He's specifically identified as the dog handler. It's not.
And did he, in your best judgment, let the dog loose? Give the order to the dog to attack? I mean, it just strikes me as terribly odd that we're sitting here at this point and there's a dispute.
It's either Graham or Quijas, and according to the reports, as I understand them and were disclosed,
but you're not prepared
it's Quijas who's the dog handler.
Yes, we know that, but I mean, sometimes another officer can order the dog loose. I mean, it's unusual, but are you saying Graham did not issue any orders? Is that what your position is?
Our position is what Graham did is he ordered the other officers back.
And that's all?
And that's all. And I think that's the only fact or even inference that the record would suggest is that Graham ordered the officers back and that Quijas is the dog handler.
Okay.
But the point I wanted to make is...
Yeah, that was a separate point. Go ahead.
Is the second point, which is Quijas is identified as the dog handler. It's not a question of... Oh, here's a report, and I'd have to go get it in order to figure that out. That's on the face of the disclosure. And I do think that that's a distinction that is of some relevance, and I wanted to share that with the court because I don't think I emphasized that well enough. He's identified, the name of the dog is identified, the officer is identified, the arrestee is identified. And that's all, it's on excerpts of record, page 244. There are a number of copies, unfortunately, of that one, so you get some duplication. But I know a real legible copy is 244, and I would invite the court to look at that because it's stated there.
You're talking about the 26A disclosure?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And other than that, unless the panel has further questions, I think I will I'll be prepared.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
Case just heard will be submitted. We thank you all for your arguments. We'll proceed with the last case on the oral argument calendar, Slade v. Baca. It's always fun to be in the audience when one of your cases is discussed, right, Mr. Yager?
Sorry.
It's always good to be in the audience when one of your cases is being discussed,
might
right?
Might be three of them, Cabrales, Santos,
yes.
And Jones.
Okay.
Good morning, Judge Thomas, Judge Pius, and Judge Reed. Nice to see you all again. All I have to say right now is that with respect to the Betty Jones case, with respect to which Judge Reed asked a question during the prior argument, since everybody's still here, I want to point out that case provides for the possibility of res ipsa loquitur, especially in Judge Silverman's dissent and also in the amended majority opinion by Judges O'Scanlan and Brunetti, With that, I'm going to reserve all of my time for rebuttal, unless the panel has questions right now.
We'll save them for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, my name is Raymond Sakai, and I represent appellee Leroy Baca. This appeal presents two issues, whether there is a genuine issue of fact presented by appellant's declaration in opposition to a defendant, appellee's summary judgment, and whether the recent amendment to the California statute of limitations applies retroactively to revive an expired case. I'd first like to briefly address the first issue, and that is whether a genuine issue of fact was created by appellant's declaration. Appellant argues in his reply brief that a quote-unquote belief is enough to create a tribal issue of fact in order to overcome the hurdle or overcome appellant's burden of production in the summary judgment, and it is appellee's position that it is not. I would first like to clarify a citation to Pelley's brief that appellant makes. It is a little bit on the misleading side. In the Bank Melli Iran case, the point of law we were citing to wasn't the sufficiency of the plaintiff in that case's declaration. And in that case, the plaintiff was the sister of the Shah of Iran. And the issue there was whether her declaration was sufficient enough to state that she would not receive due process in Iran, and therefore they couldn't enforce the judgment against her in Iran in this country. And in that case, the court said, well, we're going to look at the whole record. And it wasn't, and then the record included country reports from the State Department, I believe, stating various facts of the current regime and facts about how the Shah of Iran was not in favor. Instead, what Appelli was citing that case for was what comes two or three paragraphs after, and that is when the court says that a declaration on information and belief isn't sufficient enough to carry the burden of production to overcome a summary judgment.
He didn't say on information and belief I was released on. He says I believe that I was released on the 24th.
That is correct, and that's basically all his declaration
right.
says.
Okay, let me ask you a few questions about this declaration by Greg Siebert.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And he attaches a couple of documents to his declaration. And I note in reading Deputy Sheriff Siebert's declaration here that he says that he signed that's his signature on the jacket.
Correct. That's the cover of the booking jacket.
Right. Okay. Now, let me ask you, he doesn't go on to explain, though, the whole process for releasing somebody from county jail, which is not an which we know from cases all over the place, that's not an easy process at times.
Correct, Your Honor.
So when he stamps this released, does that mean he's pushed out the door?
This isn't in the record, but no. What happens is their inmates are taken to the inmate reception center, and they're being processed for release. What happens is they'll get a release order. This isn't a deputy. It's actually, I believe, a custody assistant or operation assistant, and they would actually administer the administrative process of release. And they get an order, and they'd stamp it. And it says, as it says here on the booking jacket, released. And then they sign it. And then it's not as though...
Is it executed right then, out the door?
That is my belief, and
So it's your belief that he was released. It's your belief that he was released on the 17th.
Well, there's a quality control check, though, from
Exactly. Mr. But what I was trying to get at is that I've been to IRC.
Whatever that means.
I'm sorry.
No, but I think that points out the problem. If the record is devoid from contrary evidence on the other side, but is there judicially noticeable facts that we have that would indicate that release stamping on this booking jacket means that the defendant was released that day?
Well, I believe it's.
Oops.
In his.
I mean, I thought his declaration was quite when I in preparing for and reading looking through all the documents that were submitted here and reading his declaration, it was very, very careful. He didn't say he was put out the door.
Well, that goes back to what I was answering before, and I was answering from my knowledge of the release process, and that there isn't. As in this courtroom, when I'm out the door, I'm out the door. I mean, that's not what it is. They are actually released out of IRC, and they are released after it is stamped release and signed release. But
he could have been released on the 17th, out the door.
And he was released on the 17th.
But was the door open and he pushed out?
Yes.
On the 17th.
And.
Or he walked out.
Well, they want to push him out these days. They're overcrowded these days. They want to push him out, right?
Yes.
So. Did that happen on the 17th?
From the records, from the booking jacket, and from the declaration, the answer would be yes.
Okay. Show me on this. Other than the words released and stamped, what else tells me on this cover the booking jacket that he was locked out the door? Because you would agree that if he was still waiting for the administrative process to be completed, he would still be in custody, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And he couldn't have gone down and filed a lawsuit, correct?
He could have filed a lawsuit. But the
statute wouldn't run, so.
Exactly. And.
So what tells me, looking at this, what tells me that he was escorted out the door?
Well, I think when you look at paragraph 4, it says, I processed and released the plaintiff. And under the.
What does paragraph 4 say?
It says, on September 17th, 2000, I processed and released the plaintiff. Melvin Lewis Slade from the custody of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. And under the plain language of
But you're not telling me that you're telling me that released also has another meaning.
That if I may go back to my answer, this is not on the record, but it's on my information and knowledge. The process.
That's okay. Just go ahead.
But, you know, a release is a release. And
there's a recent Ninth Circuit case, I can't give you the name of it, where a fellow sues, I think it's the Los Angeles case, because he was ordered released, but they didn't turn him loose for like 39 hours. And that case indicates that there's a system that said we release 600 people a day and we can't get around to this, and eventually I think his case fails. You know that case?
It's the Brass case. I believe it's Brass versus County of Los Angeles.
Does that reflect the practices of Los Angeles?
No, that case is different because the last step in the release process, again, is when a custody assistant or the, in this case, it is the operations assistant, stamps the booking jacket release, he signs his name off of that. And also, this isn't in the record either, but there is also a computer database that is scanned in, and it indicates IRC-8, which is basically the inmate's out. And that's the last step.
What was that?
There's a computer database system that also tracks the inmates in the county of Los Angeles. In the Brass case, they're talking about the whole release process. You know, from the time an inmate comes back from court till the time he goes through IRC, and he's ultimately released. And in that case, we're talking about from the time he's ordered release till the time he's actually released, and the Ninth Circuit said, well, I believe, I can't remember off the top of my head, but like 39 hours is not unreasonable. This isn't brass. And when we're talking about when our Mr. Slade was released, we're going off of the last step of the release process.
Now, is that whole release process described in this declaration?
No, it isn't.
Okay.
And again, going off of the plain language of this declaration, saying that this is when he was released.
When you say, I believe I was released on a certain date, would you say that could be a way that you express yourself? Some people kind of talk in that sort of term. What about that?
Well, in this case, we're not dealing with a pro per litigant. We're dealing with a represented plaintiff by experienced counsel. And the implication of the plain language implication of the declaration is that.
But the lawyer put down what his client said and made that the affidavit. So his client said, I believed. The lawyer didn't coach him and say, you better not say, I believe. You better lay it on the line, the date you were released.
But maybe I'm misunderstanding. So what Your Honor is asking, that maybe in this case this was more of a slang or
a way of expressing yourself.
Exactly.
Don't some people talk in those terms?
I believe they do, but I believe also that I'm sorry. To my knowledge, people do. But in the case where you're represented by counsel, and the counsel knows the law and what is required by Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 56E, it's incumbent upon counsel to craft a declaration that would be sufficient to carry the burden. And through my research, although it's a recent 11th Circuit case which wasn't cited in the briefs, but the facts are almost on, they're very similar to this case. In that case, it's Pace v. Capio Bianco, and that's.
There's a sheet that you can give to the clerk afterwards, so why don't you?
Well, the facts in that case are, it was a 1983 excessive force case, and defendants were police officers. They brought a.
I think we can read the case, okay. Because it's unfair now to, if you haven't noticed other counsel, your case to counsel that comment. But we'll read it.
And the only other thing I have to say about that is that the declaration in that case was basically the same, saying, I believe this happened.
Yes.
Okay. With the court's permission, I'd like to move on to the retroactive application of the California Statute of Limitations provision. Appellee's position is that Landgraf controls in this case, and Landgraf does not change the presumption, actually embraces the presumption, against retroactivity of a statute. The case is cited by appellant in his opening brief are not on all fours on this issue. Plaintiff cites appellant, cites Usher and Rivera. Those two cases deal with whether the court is going to retroactively apply judicial decisions, not statutes. And it relies on a different test, and that's the Chevron Oil v. Hudson test set out by the Supreme Court. In Landgraf, we're dealing with the retroactive application of a statute. The first part of the Landgraf test is whether there is a plain language intent, whether or not this statute apply retroactively or not. In Landgraf,
I don't want to break into your argument, but just one thing. If we were to decide that the affidavit or the declaration of the plaintiff raises a genuine issue of material fact, would we have to reach the question of the retroactivity of the California statute?
No, you would not.
All right, go on, please.
So the first prong, or the first part of the test, is whether or not there is this clear legislative intent. And in Landgraf, there wasn't. And in this case, there is loads of legislative intent that we can look to. And in enacting the statute, there is the Senate bill, the legislative record, and there is also Code of Civil Procedure Section 340.10 and 335.1. The Section 340.10 specifically says that we're going to apply this retroactively to victims of the 9/11 terrorist attack. It doesn't say anything else about retroactive application to any of the other claims that may be revived.
You know, I find that interesting because the statute says is a prime example of the inequities, and then it just refers to September 11th.
But when you look at, as in the Landgraf case, when it says, well, okay, we'll also look at the legislative intent, and the legislative intent is...
Well, that's when the statute is silent. I mean, the statute is made expressly retroactive, then that's the end of the analysis. What's your best argument that the statute itself was limited in its retroactive effect to those who were victims of terrorist attacks of 9/11?
I believe that's in the legislative intent, in the legislative record, where it says... Basically, what it says in 340.10 that we're extending the statute of limitations and it's specifically going to apply retroactively to the victims of terrorism. But say that the court feels it is ambiguous, and we have to go to the second test that Landgraf requires. Mm-hmm. And that second test is whether or not this statute would be, if applied, would have an impermissible retroactive effect. And there's a specific definition about retroactive effect. In Landgraf, it says impair the rights of parties, possess when acted, increase parties' liability for past conduct, and imposes a new duty in law. Appellant argues that also grafted onto Landgraf is this dichotomy between procedural and substantive changes in the law, or our laws. And that if it's procedural, then we could apply it retroactively, and it's substantive, we can't. And following this line of argument, appellant argues that, well, we're going to have to apply California state law regarding retroactivity. But that is wrong. In the Two Rivers case, the Ninth Circuit said, while Wilson v. Garcia says we're going to borrow the state's statute of limitations law and their tolling provisions, we're not going to borrow the state's retroactivity interpretation. And that's a question of federal law. And so since we're going to use federal law, we look at Chenault, another Ninth Circuit case, which says, well, we'll look at the difference between procedural and substantive, but in some cases, changes will have substantive effects. And that was a holding in... We will not revive plaintiff's claim.